On spaceship Earth, I suppose man would indeed for the first time have to become a social animal. Contrary to his mythology of the past. First discussant, Dr. Joseph Fitzgerald, Atlantic Richfield Company, Anchorage. Dr. Fitzgerald.
Mr. Chairman, members of my tired audience, I sympathize deeply with you all. If you became sleepy conservationists and not aroused conservationists, I think we could blame it on 2 days and two nights of intensive discussion, so that I will try to be brief. I might even try to be pointed. A conference, and this is a conference, demonstrates the capacity of man to translate a problem into words. And I suppose a discussant is simply one who rearranges the words and hopefully at some point manages to crystallize some thought or other. I was particularly impressed by our speakers today. I think that they have pinpointed some of the really key and central issues. Dr. Caldwell put it, I think, for everyone. He said, the great challenge to Alaska is to the intelligence and to the moral sense. In other words, a crisis of the will. In amplification of that, I'd like to go back to what Dr. Darling said about England, its environment, its 1 acre per person. And to make this point, and to emphasize, underscore for Americans, because I think Americans really need to have this point brought home, that the great desecration around the cities of the United States is not a necessary thing at all. It's a reflection of the character of Americans. And I feel that everybody should really let that rub in, that you go to England, with several thousand years of intensive occupation, it has its open spaces, it has its beauty. The environment isn't something merely to be consumed. It's to be lived in, it's to be used, possibly to be changed, but not to be consumed. And it is for this reason that the English can worry about the consumption of 10 acres per day. Ours would probably be in the many thousands of acres per day. I think this point is well worth bringing home because a conservationist is going to do, as Dr. Darling says, start in the backyard. One of the points that he made, and it is a point of conflict, I think here, I think Dr. Caldwell doesn't quite agree with Dr. Darling on the possibility of oil and its impact in Alaska in making possible a systems approach to ecology. Will government do well or will it do badly? Maybe one of the reasons state governments have done badly in the United States is the rather misapplication of tax funds between state and federal government. Poverty is never the way to strength. And I think this is a tax lesson that I suggest that some of us give time to. But with that background, what can oil do? Well, very simply, the resources of Alaska, timber, fisheries, gold mining, copper mining, have never in the past produced much for the government of Alaska. This government was created after statehood with a very, very narrow economic base. Most of the land is federally owned. Most of the big installations are federally owned and tax-free. Oil, for the first time, gives the state of Alaska a revenue base on which it can do things. And I suggest that there's a very high possibility that Alaska will do very well with its oil revenues. We hope so. There's a lot of us here who are quite dedicated to making this government work. But if it does work, it's true, as Dr. Darling said, We can now, at this time in history, set aside the wilderness, the parks, the recreation areas. We can go into multiple-use management of our lands, recognizing that 99% of the land of this state is essentially wilderness and will remain so. So it's wise management, the introduction of land into use from that land bank. These are the things we must control, and I hope we do. Back of all that we're talking, of course, is the problem of making our policies, our thoughts on ecology, the conservation of the environment, effective. And I'd like to talk a little about this because it hasn't been enunciated in governmental terms, and yet I find that's the way I think. I spent a good deal of time with U.S. government, a good deal of time in the regulatory field, and it does color my approach to these problems. I think it's obvious to everyone that we've had great difficulty in developing policy and getting organizations which are responsive to the environmental problems of our times. In many ways, I suppose this reflects the fact that the interest in ecology was not broad enough to bring the pressure on either the state or federal government for affirmative action. There is a start in the Congress today, and I suggest this is where we should start. We can't ask a single agency to enunciate the basic policies, for the simple reason that there's no single agency that's responsible for every aspect of environmental management that we must deal. So the logical place to begin is in the Congress. And the major thrust, which I hope many of you will follow, is to push in the direction of getting the overall comprehensive policy statements through the Congress. And if you get it through wisely and well with sufficient support, I'm sure it'll help in the appropriation process to implement some of those programs. But government, of course, is administered by agencies. And here, I think I would say that you really have two problems. You have the problem of the control of government itself, and you have the problem of the control of the private sector, the individual, the corporation. Now, with regard to the control of the government itself, and this is a real problem because it's a big operator, you can do this through a National Science Foundation approach, and probably that approach has great attractiveness because budgetary control is one that gets and keeps the attention of the mule day after day, year after year. But you'll have to have some such approach in government, and it's purely a pragmatic decision you must make. You must make one which is going to be effective, and that's the only test for the organizational structure, what's most effective. When we come to the second problem, we're in the classical field of regulation, and government regulation is a very specialized subject, hemmed in by many laws, many practices. As I see it, you probably are going to have to lodge this in some agency or create a new one. And I think the logical body probably is the Department of Interior. As a matter of fact, I think I could make a very strong case that if you were to take and reorganize Department of Interior with its basic orientations towards environmental management, we would then be re-equipping it to go into the next century. But today, in fact, it represents a series of independent principalities which are largely hangovers from the 19th century. And I don't say that in a derogatory standpoint at all. Government gets into this. Machinery usually outlasts its usefulness. And this is one thing which should be very, very carefully thought about. And I personally would deeply, strongly support that approach. Now, we've talked only about the federal government, and I would like to say something about the role of the state. Again, the states are challenged, and it's pretty hard to answer. But I think there's some things that ought to be said about the role of the state. Under our Constitution, the states have those powers not specifically granted to the federal government. Now, those state powers normally involve the regulation of economic activities, the exercise of the ordinary range of police powers, whether they're controlling smoke in the atmosphere or what they're doing. Obviously, there must be some device found to try to bring local state policies into conformity with national policies. If you don't, you get a conflict, and this results to frustration and inactivity. Probably the art of government is the art of getting something done, and the art of getting something done with government is very much of eliminating the conflict somehow so that the natural range of agreement which people have can come to the fore and be asserted. Now, people have talked about cooperative federalism. It's an overworked and another under-implemented term. Maybe we need a new term to do it, but I strongly feel that some joint state-federal type of machinery is going to have to be developed. And we've never developed such machinery before on a very large scale or a very effective way. So I recognize that this is a pretty hard prescription that I'm asking for. There's one special point I want to make about Alaska, because one of the focus here today is obviously on Alaska. Most of Alaska, as I said before, is owned by the federal government, and the people are not, I don't think, willing to accept federal ownership of land as an excuse for a new form of colonialism. And I repeat that. Colonialism has always been a psychological problem of major proportions in this state. Since resources are the major economic force in our way of life, since they're almost entirely under the control of federal government, there is a most delicate governmental problem presented by how you administer, how you carry out. And if it's done without the cooperation and organizational support of the state, I think you're going to find that the people of the state and the people in the nation are going to become loggerheads, and that it's going to be to the detriment of everyone. So I most strongly urge that great consideration be given to this point. I'm sure we can put together joint organizations which can accomplish it. I think that's all I want to say. I feel that these meetings that we've been having have been useful. They've been useful to government, to the academic world, and to industry in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fitzgerald. The other discussant, Mr. William J. Van Ness, Jr., native of Northwest Washington, received his Bachelor of Arts degree at Western Washington State College and his Bachelor of Laws degree at my alma mater, the University of Washington. He's counsel to the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee since 1966 and has published articles in Law Review and various special committee reports. Mr. Van Ness.
Thank you, Dr. Martz. I have just a few brief remarks in terms of my employment. I guess I'm involved somewhat in terms of where do we go from here. We've heard about problems, problems of population, problems of too many people on too few acres, the deterioration in the quality of life in our cities, the pollution, the crowding, the poorly designed transportation systems that we have in the United States, certainly in most of our major cities, that Dr. Darling has alluded to, that England is currently experiencing. We have a different set of problems that here in Alaska, I think, although I've only been here a few days and had an opportunity to see only a portion of the state, the problems here are different, but I think one of the concerns that has been expressed here by the speakers today is that there's a danger, and a very, very real danger, I think, that we aren't going to learn from the past experience, from the problems that we now experience in, quote, civilization, unquote, south of here and in Europe. And here we have a tremendous opportunity in Alaska to capitalize on all of those past failures, all of those past problems. In each of them, there's somebody went up a blind alley, and there's an opportunity to go in a new direction here. And I think this is why, perhaps to the chagrin and of many Alaskans, this is why people in Europe, people in the lower 48 states, 49 states, feel that they have a stake in Alaska. They have a sense of involvement here. There's an opportunity to do things right, to plan the cities that you are going to have here better than we plan the cities that that we now have. An opportunity to get right at the point where technology, as it comes to the north here, to develop these great resources and to make them available, to relate them to man and to improve man's way of life, and I think in Alaska, especially the Native Alaskans' way of life, right at this interface, as technology comes and as capital pours in, here we have an opportunity to do something totally new, that we can direct this technology, we can guide it, we can draw some limitations, we can say we're going to do things different than we have in the past, we're not going through the same repetition of errors that we've had in the past, and I think this is why there is so much focus here in Alaska, because these are perhaps the most critical, certainly one of the most critical domestic problems I think that we face today is this interface between technology and the quality of life. What's life about? What values are we trying to perpetuate? What do they have to do with highways, which are simply means to get to work, and very often it's an unhappy form of work where there is no self-satisfaction. So I'm very much in sympathy, I think, with what the three speakers have said to you today, but what we're up against now is, where do we go from here? These men have spoken very eloquently, I think, on the problems, but they haven't dealt with the specifics, the real tough problems. How do you, should you, if you decide to, bring a major development such as the oil development you're having here today, how do you regulate that? What are the right answers? The ecologists are concerned, we're all concerned, I think, but very few of them seem to have answers. They want to study 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Many say that this isn't the answer. We don't have the time to study on some of these things. That the people that are generating this technology, for all practical purposes in control of it, aren't going to wait 5 years and aren't going to wait 2 years, and that there's a real important gap here. Now, whether you bridge it by developing more ecologists, trained ecologists to advise people, I don't know. I think that's probably not the answer. I think the answer is perhaps to, for all of us, certainly for all in government, I should think, and certainly for all in industry, to become not necessarily ecologists, but just to adopt an ecological point of view, to look beyond the specifics of what is happening here. And this is one of the things that I did want to have make a few remarks on, that I think Senate Bill 1075, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, is directed towards. What it's trying to do, basically, is saying to all federal agencies, and it is simply directed to federal agencies and federal jurisdiction, it does not affect private rights, private individuals, or state jurisdiction, but it says to the federal government, let's put our own house in order. Let's just state those goals and those values which the federal government shares as representatives of the people, those things that that we want to perpetuate, those ideals we want to strive after as part of the government process. And the bill attempts to state these and has to state them very broadly and very generally, quite obviously, because as soon as you get down into the specifics and the specific applications of what we'd all agree, I think, are very important values, but they're abstract. But when you get down to the specifics of applying them, you get two polarized points of view with half here, half there. But at least this was the attempt to state that, to say in law that this is now the mandate of every federal agency, that they have a responsibility to try to maximize those values and to maximize the man-environment relationship. And this is something new, something important, I think, because it came as a surprise to me to discover that many agencies of the federal government, and the federal government is concerned about the quality of life, about water pollution, air pollution, these types of things, but the federal government has evolved structurally so that it has an agency that is concerned about water pollution, but it also has very often 195 others that aren't concerned about it because that's not their mission. It's not their mandate. They're dam builders, or they're managing a forest, or they're building thermal power reactors, this type of thing. So what we've done, or what has been done with this legislation, is to state some fairly simple, broad, general environmental management goals and values, and to say that the law is now amended, and this is now part of your mandate, part of your concern, and everything that you do. And this means a change in the way of doing business for many of these agencies. Many have construed their enabling acts to limit what they can do in terms of environmental administration, environmental management. The classic one, of course, is Atomic Energy Commission. Their concern runs to radiation safety, but not to the impact of thermal pollution upon waters. Well, it's ironic, or at least I found it ironic, that government is that limited, that circumscribed, that narrow in point of view, that narrow in terms of mission, that it's become that specialized. So I think this will go far towards rectifying a specific problem. It means that in the future, that when government attempts to initiate an action, it has to sit back and take the ecological overview, I guess, is one way to characterize it for want of a better characterization, to look at all of the alternatives, try to identify all of the relationships, and try to make a knowledgeable and sophisticated judgment of the impact of government's actions, and not necessarily actions in the sense of building or doing something, but I think the thing that Mr. Fitzgerald was concerned about was the impact of a government monetary policy. What's the impact of a change in a general statute, which has nothing to do with building things, but what is the impact of it on a state or upon a community? What's the impact on the federal-state relationship? That this is an important thing, and now there's a directive to look at these things, try to look at the whole, but always to be looking at it in terms of the value that you're trying to perpetuate. When you're building a dam, one of the values, of course, is to be generating power, to sell power. And there are many people in a federal bureau, if it's a federal project, that add up those kilowatt per hours and find some satisfaction, some goal achievement there. But that's really not a very important thing, in my judgment. The important thing is, what are those kilowatts for? How and who are they going to benefit man? And what are the costs of doing that, the social costs and the economic costs, both? The Rampart Dam is one that perhaps most of you are more familiar with than I am, a little bit before my time in some senses, and that the controversy preceded me. But there's tremendous social costs here, tremendous problems that haven't been looked at. And this bill would attempt to put these on the table and attempt to evaluate these social costs. The bill also, in addition to having the statement of goals, has a number of action-forcing provisions, because one of the problems of policy is that policy sounds fine, people can adhere to it, and they can also ignore it. It's government by press release in some respects that we all pay some adherence, some oral adherence at least, to policies that seem to involve these values that are widely shared, but when it comes to the action, when the crunch is on, they're very often ignored. They're very often in the breach, so there are provisions in the bill to observe these. The third section of the bill, which I think is very important, is a research and intelligence function in terms of what is it we are doing to the environment, in terms of the day-to-day impact, what is happening to the land base, how is it changing, what is happening to the air and water around us, what is happening to the state of Alaska, and how fast is it proceeding, is it good? And if we continue these trends that we now see underway here in Alaska, for example, where are we going to be in 20 years or 30 years? And try to get a feel for that and look back on it and say, is that where we want to be? Is that where we want to go? I think that's especially more important in the other states, the industrialized, the developed states, that we have an opportunity to have a feel what the trends are, what forces are pushing us, what type of a life we're being driven to. The fourth major section of the bill is that it establishes a board of environmental advisors in the Office of the President, and the board is patterned after the Board of Council of Economic Advisors, which, in the judgment of many, has been a very successful staff adjunct to the President, and more than a staff adjunct, because these are very prestigious, very knowledgeable people who have an impact on and a tremendous impact on the economic policies we follow, and therefore on the employment and the viability of our country economically. The fifth major aspect of the bill is that it requires an annual environmental quality report that will establish some baselines and will tell us where we're going, where we've been, have we made any progress since last year, and a whole variety of areas that involve the satisfaction or of the man-environment relationship. I think that's all, Dr. Marks, and have questions.
Thank you, Bill. Your criticism may be valid that we've identified our hunger and rather eloquently described it. It's nice to hear that at least a bill is in the mill, which will help get the fire started and preparations for a meal underway. We have just a few minutes. I'm sorry that time is running out. Any questions? Yes, sir.
I think that Mr. Fitzgerald alluded to some points that ought to be spelled out a little more, but those of us that have been in state government or in federal service in Alaska recognize that the job is bigger than all of us, and that the primary effort ought to be in coordination of efforts between federal and state agencies, not only the Department of Interior, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Defense. All these agencies, as well as private industry, need to stand up and work together. I'd like to see you both spell out a little more the framework of federal-state cooperation.
Well, that's a fairly large bill.
5 minutes.
No, I shall be very brief. In my testimony before the Senate Public Works Commission last year, I testified on this problem with respect to the Federal Field Committee for Development Planning in Alaska and how I thought it should be reorganized in relation to the state and how the two should set up their planning agencies and how they should be brought together. And I think this is what has to happen. There has to be some form of equality in participation between the state and the federal government, and we need organization to do it. You can do it by having a state planning organization or environmental control or whatever it is, one side. You can have something on the federal side, whether it's a federal field committee or what it is. Then you bring them together. But you can't bring them together if it's solely under federal chairmanship or something. And this is why we went to the dual chairmanship approach. And I strongly urge that we give this a chance to work. In addition, when we move into environmental problems, you have to expand it beyond just state and federal. You have to provide for public participation of some kind for the affected parties. And so I would recommend that we draft up some proposals along this line. But I strongly feel that nothing happens without the proper framework within which it can happen, and that where we're hung up on conservation as much as anything is in government, that we aren't organized for it statewide or federally. And that's why I tried to touch rather briefly, broadly, on the problem this morning.
Question here on the aisle.
My question was for Professor Caldwell. Dr. Scott had indicated, I thought, that decision-making was much the crux of this question of implementation of the technology. And then Professor Caldwell had mentioned policy, and as a government specialist, I'd sort of hoped he might indicate to us how these policy decisions were to be made. But from then on, it seemed to me that the panel took the approach of telling Alaskans what they were to do with their resources. It became from then on policy determinations by the panelists. Now, my question is, on what basis, in theory, can you assume that these are the policy choices to be made? Now, the only argument that I could see come forward was that states are venal and try to prove otherwise. And I react to this strongly as a Canadian caught up in the same context. And maybe I can identify more with an Alaskan here than with the panelists. But I determined to challenge this assumption, which comes at us so often. And I spent several years doing comprehensive study of land policies in the United States and Canada. And while I wouldn't take up your challenge, I would say that there's nothing in the history that shows that the federal government has been less venal, both in Canada or in the United States. And there's nothing in the immediate history prior to this discovery in Prudhoe Bay which suggests that the federal administration has shown foresight. And I don't want to contribute to exacerbation of these relationships, but I think that it's a positive thing rather than a negative thing to suggest that this condescension should stop. The state, in many respects, I think, can be shown to have positive things in its favor for determination of these issues. In many ways, they can do it better. Bigness isn't, by itself, a superiority in decision-making. And I felt that I had to bring this out, and my question then to Professor Caldwell was, on what basis, what contribution can be made about this process of decision-making?
Well, I had not been aware that at least my remarks were directed toward any specific policies or decision process for Alaska. In fact, I tried to avoid that. I certainly don't consider myself competent, really, to, in any very specific way, to comment on what Alaska ought to do or ought not to do. What I was trying to do was to state the context or the frame reference in which those decisions were going to have to be made. Now, with respect to the competence of state government to contribute to them, my remarks were not intended to be condescending in any sense of the word, and I would agree with you that bigness does not necessarily mean betterness. And I certainly could document the failures and iniquities of the federal government as well as I could those of the states. And indeed, there have been notable examples of foresight and effectiveness in some of the states. What I'm simply saying is that in the aggregate, the record of state government in the United States does not, in my judgment, encourage the thought that Alaskan state government And we're not to assume that Alaskan state government will be able to handle the situation. Now, I certainly concur with the thought that was just expressed, that there needs to be a partnership. We need to have some institutional innovation. We need to combine the resources of both federal government and the states. And for my part, rather than to be negative, I would hope that one could take a very positive view to demonstrating here in Alaska how this kind of a relationship might be effective and indeed could point the way to the more effective handling of many problems that we are still grappling with in the lower 48, Appalachia, for example. So then I think if I left you with a negative or condescending impression here, I'm glad that I've had the opportunity, I hope, to correct it, because this was not my intention. And indeed, I think what I wanted to do was to pose the challenge in as realistic terms as I knew how.
I forgot to ask you to, for the record, identify yourself, please.
Professor Thompson from UBC.
Thank you. And with that, I'm afraid if there are other questions, I'll ask you to address them privately to the members of the panel. Thank the panel very much, and the closing is adjourned.